next case, Miller versus Wolpoff versus Abramson, will be submitted on the briefs. And then we'll go on to argument in Starkweather versus Smith, number 082354.
May I, Your Honor? Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Hennick. I represent Jay Starkweather on this appeal from denial of a federal habeas petition. Excuse me. The issue, although we've raised other issues, the issue I'd like to address today concerns the ineffectiveness claim resulting from trial counsel's failure to provide accurate and complete information to his client regarding the issue of whether he should accept counsel's belief that he should not testify at trial at all, or at least not testify until the second phase of the trial. Under Wisconsin law, when a defendant raises a not guilty by reason of insanity claim, the resulting trial is bifurcated, meaning that the first part of the trial, the first phase, addresses issues of guilt or innocence. The second phase addresses mental responsibility, that is, whether or not he has a mental disease or defect, and as a result of that, cannot understand the wrongfulness of his actions or comply with the requirements of law. In this case, Mr. Starkweather made it clear that he wanted to tell his side of the story at some point during this trial. He made clear when he ultimately did testify in the second phase of the trial that at least part of that of his statement, his testimony, was that, number one, he did not kill Ted Demery, the person he was charged with killing, and number two, when it came to the individuals he was supposedly attempting to kill, that he was acting in what he believed to be self-defense. However, this was presented at the second phase of the trial, where innocence and guilt are irrelevant, and the only issue was the mental responsibility. The reason why it was presented at the second phase is because his lawyer told him that his testimony would better fit in the second phase of the trial. That's where the unreasonable, the deficient performance comes in. It was patently unreasonable for any lawyer to tell someone who says, "I didn't do it," to tell that person to hold off until it's no longer relevant. It's like telling a defendant who claims he didn't do it to hold off and make his statement at sentencing rather than at trial. It's just patently unreasonable. The lower courts and Ms. Smith view this not as a question of whether or not the advice was accurate, but whether or not the attorney had a reasonable belief that his client either shouldn't testify at all or should hold off testifying. A strategy decision.
As far as the didn't do it defense.
Yes.
I was confused a little. I wasn't sure whether he said, well, maybe the guy was already dead or earlier, or maybe in the shootout he got shot. And I wasn't clear which, and given that alternative where he would testify, which one was it?
His testimony was that on the morning after he had the conflict with Mr. Ostrung and Mr. Kittleson, he went out traveling around the Picnic Point area. He went to Demery's house, or his trailer. He found Demery dead. He was already dead at that point. So his testimony would actually support the theory that was presented. Two theories were presented at trial concerning the homicide, two defense theories. The first was an individual who lived right next door, actually a babysitter from right next door, heard an argument and a gunshot the night before around midnight. And it was one of the theories presented at trial that Demery was already dead before Mr. Starkweather did anything that day.
With the same weapon that was found next
that, that he ended up having, yes. He testified.
So somebody else would have had to gotten that same weapon and killed Demery, and then when your client went and got it, same weapon, and was shooting with it, and apparently that was the bullet from that weapon that was found in the guy's head.
There were two handguns. One was actually Mr. Starkweather's. That was the 9mm. The second, the 38 caliber, was Starkweather's father's. That was Leo Starkweather. And the way that was explained at trial is that Jay Starkweather had the 9mm. He then went to his father's house, according to his father, who had died prior to trial, but his prior testimony was allowed in. The father said that he then took the other gun and stomped off from there. Jay Starkweather's testimony was that he did not shoot Demery. When he got to Demery's trailer, Demery was dead. The 38 was there. He picked it up then.
Nice.
Keep in mind that throughout this entire process, the only time that Starkweather is alleged to have shot the 38 was to kill Demery. During the shootout with the police, the subsequent shootout with the police, even though he had two guns, he only shot the 9mm. So it just seems strange that if he was only going to shoot one shot and he actually killed Demery, that it would come from the other gun that he was using, that he never used any other time during that day. Now, the issue of deficient performance, no reasonable lawyer would have told his client that testimony regarding his innocence.
His lawyer gave him a reason or didn't tell him the real reason on the theory that he wouldn't follow the advice if he did, so he gave him some other reason, which was not the true reason. That the question, in order to get avail of yourself of federal habeas under AEDPA, you've got to indicate what Supreme Court precedent that violates. Now, I don't know of any Supreme Court precedent on the issue of what the lawyer not advising his client of the basis for his advice.
The Supreme Court authority we're relying on is Strickland, that provides that an attorney has to act reasonably. And there have been multiple cases from this court as well as other courts in which the attorney's advice or the attorney's actions did not independently violate a United States Supreme Court standard, but that still he acted unreasonably, and therefore finding that the attorney acted reasonably was an unreasonable application of Supreme Court standards in Strickland. For instance, we have the Moran case, although it deals with appellate ineffectiveness, in which the issue was whether the attorney acted unreasonably in failing to raise a state evidentiary claim. Now, obviously, there is no U.S. Supreme Court decision that says that it's a violation of the Constitution to fail to raise a state not address a state evidentiary violation. That's an issue of state law. But the standard as a whole for ineffectiveness is whether or not there's deficient performance and whether or not there's resulting prejudice. That's a federal standard, and that's the issue that we're relying on.
Unreasonable advice, considering that the defendant had a mental problem?
Well, we have to distinguish here between two different pieces of advice. Number one, what the lower courts relied on and what Ms. Smith relies on is the advice that he hold off to testify until the mental responsibility phase. That might be reasonable. But the second piece of advice is what the consequences of that are. In this case, the consequences are that his testimony concerning guilt and innocence would never be heard by the jury when it would matter. That's like saying that somebody, you know, I can give you advice to accept a plea offer, but not tell you what the consequences of that are. It may be perfectly reasonable to suggest that he take the plea offer, but it is not reasonable to fail to give him the information necessary for the defendant to make that decision. And remember here, the decision whether to testify is the defendant's to make, and that is Rock v. Arkansas. Thank you. I see that I'm in my time.
Mentally defective defendant, though.
He was not incompetent.
It's the problem, doesn't it?
He was not incompetent to be tried. He was competent to testify. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. State of Wisconsin Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien appears on behalf of the respondent appellee, Warden Smith. Jay Starkweather received a fair trial represented by competent counsel who made sound strategic decisions and put on a plausible defense against overwhelming evidence of his guilt in a virtually impossible situation. That is what trial judge Benjamin Proctor held. That is what the Wisconsin Court of Appeals has repeatedly held. That is what the district court held. This court must also so hold because this is the Wisconsin courts reasonably apply the principles of Strickland v. Washington to these rather bizarre facts. Counsel reasonably advised his client to testify at phase two and not at phase one because in light of the overwhelming evidence of his guilt, the jury simply would not have believed it. At least a reasonable defense attorney could conclude that the jury would not have believed his testimony in phase one, that he shot two unarmed friends in self-defense and did not shoot Ted Demery, even though he had just shot two unarmed friends and then moments later shot at several police officers. Rather, the testimony was more relevant at phase two to establish what Mr. Starkweather had to prove, the affirmative defense of that he was suffering from a mental disease or defect that rendered him incapable of conforming his conduct to the requirements of the law. That testimony, a reasonable defense attorney could conclude, actually better fit in phase two, even though, yes, it denied guilt, even though the proof of guilt was overwhelming, and claimed self-defense, even though there was no basis for self-defense. And in fact, at the time of trial, the trial judge might very well have not allowed a self-defense instruction because under Wisconsin law at that time, your belief in the right to use self-defense, especially deadly force, had to be a reasonable one. And the evidence showed that this was a patently unreasonable belief
on his part.
You're
saying you can mislead your client as long as it's good for him to mislead him?
No one misled anyone here.
Well, he didn't tell him that his testimony wouldn't apply to his guilt or innocence.
I don't quite understand the court's question.
Well, that was the point that was made, was that his lawyer did not tell him that if he didn't testify in phase one, it wouldn't affect, you know, it wouldn't be applied to the issue of guilt or innocence, right?
Well, there was no evidentiary hearing, so we don't know exactly what was the discussion. And the burden of proof is on the petitioner to establish what was said. And there is nothing to indicate that the lawyer misled him at all. And I would suggest...
Well, he didn't tell him that, right?
Pardon me?
He didn't tell him what your opponent has just indicated, is he failed to tell him that his testimony would not have any effect on his guilt or innocence.
Well, I'm not sure what he told him. Every indication here seems to indicate that that the discussion would be that, yes, you could testify. However, again, and Mr. Starkweather went on the record, and there's a clear record of waiver where he was asked, did you discuss this with your attorney? Are you willing to give up your right to testify in phase one? He knew he could get on the stand. He knew the decision was his. The record is clear on that, and there's no dispute on that. The decision was his. He knew that he could get on the stand and say, I deny guilt. On the other hand, a reasonable attorney could say, well, you could. However, it's better in phase two because there, and again, as your colleague points out, it's difficult when you're dealing with someone who's suffering, who you believe is suffering from a mental disease or defect. And I would ask that you review Mr. Starkweather's testimony. It really is delusional and confused and uncorroborated by anything that happened. And a reasonable attorney could look at that proposed testimony and say, you know, we've got to go for the insanity defense. I don't see how that can be second-guessed here. And it's certainly a reasonable conclusion. Perhaps another attorney would allow his client to take the stand, and it is allowed in Wisconsin law, to testify at both phases. But what would have happened there is, in light of the overwhelming evidence of his guilt, the jury would have found him guilty, and then counsel would have been put in the difficult position at phase two of putting on basically the same testimony and then asking the same jury to conclude that well, this testimony once found incredible now supports an insanity defense. Now, perhaps that could be done, but I think that's a very risky strategy. I think it tends to, a reasonable attorney can conclude that that could prejudice the jury in what he believes to be the stronger phase of the trial, phase two, in trying to convince the jury that, yes, my client committed these heinous acts, but he did so as a result of paranoid schizophrenia, that he couldn't control himself. And that I don't see there's no evidence in this record that this attorney lied to his client or misled his client in any respect. And again, the petitioner has the burden of proof on that, in proving deficient performance. And we would suggest that this was eminently reasonable conduct to advise the client, let's go with your testimony in phase two. That's the stronger point. You know, again, this whole business, we have to look at what happened here in the context of the entire case. It's nice in an academic sense to say, well, my client denies guilt as to shooting Demery, therefore I should put him on the stand. On the other hand, you have to look at it in the context of the admitted guilt, and Demery admitted in his bizarre testimony that he intentionally shot both Austring and Kittleson, and that he shot at the police officers. And so in evaluating the impact of the denial of guilt, you have to look at the context. And I would also suggest, in evaluating the performance of counsel, let's not forget that he, in essence, got his client's denial into evidence when he was able to introduce the statement Demery made from his hospital bed to the police. When the officer asked him how many people did he shoot, Demery, who was unable to talk at the time, held up two fingers, which trial counsel adeptly used to argue that, see, he only admitted to shooting Austring and Kittleson. And to extrapolate from there, therefore, jury, you must infer that he did not shoot Ted Demery. And so you avoid all the pratfalls of putting him on the stand and being cross-examined about, okay, you're denying shooting Demery, but don't you admit to shooting Austring? Don't you admit to shooting Kittleson just a few minutes earlier? Don't you admit to shooting the cops a few minutes later? You avoid that cross-examination by putting in the statement to police that I held up two fingers. I only shot those first two men, my two friends. And so, again, under the AEDPA, this court is bound to the determination of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals that this was reasonable trial strategy unless it is willing to go so far as to conclude that it's patently unreasonable. And under these circumstances, I frankly don't know that Mr. Starkweather could have gotten better representation from anyone. Unless there are any further questions, I'll conclude my argument. Thank you.
Thank you. What's the time? I gave you an extra minute if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. The reason why there was no hearing in this case is because the state adamantly, vehemently opposed having any kind of a hearing at any point in the proceedings, and they were successful in the state court. So even though it's our burden, they're the ones that avoided having the evidence that they say is now missing. The supposed overwhelming evidence, I would note that on the issue of Demery's death, the jury already had the testimony of the babysitter next door that there was a shot and an argument the night before. They had the evidence that the Starkweather had no motive. They had evidence from the police officers that the body had already bled out by the time that they arrived, just minutes after they claimed that Mr. Starkweather shot Demery. They have the evidence of the police refusal to allow a medical examiner to even look at the body until 12 hours after the supposed shooting. And they also had the evidence of the defendant's indication in the hospital that he only shot two people. That doesn't indicate overwhelming evidence, and that would have only corroborated Starkweather's testimony that he did not shoot Demery. As for the other witnesses, it is not overwhelming evidence when the trial judge grants lesser-included offense instructions on virtually every other charge in the case, whether it's the shooting of Austring and Kittleson or the shooting toward the police. And indeed, the court granted a self-defense instruction regarding at least one of the police officers. So the evidence is not overwhelming in those circumstances when even without the defendant's testimony, the judge sees it as sufficient for a lesser-included offense instruction. Finally, imperfect self-defense. Obviously, it doesn't apply to Demery because we aren't alleging Demery there. But under Wisconsin law, State v. Head, the state Supreme Court held that as... I'm sorry. May I finish my thought?
Yeah.
Yes. Under State v. Head, the Wisconsin homicide law, as it had been in effect since 1987, the legislature intended that an actual belief that one is acting in self-defense is a defense to first-degree intentional homicide, or as in this case as well, attempted first-degree intentional homicide. It doesn't have to be reasonable. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.